a race to resolve a standoff to avert what would be an unprecedented default on the U.S. debt.
If the currency and debts of the United States are no longer credible, then that ripple will shake the entire global economy.
Plus, reports of fighting despite a fresh ceasefire agreement in Sudan as civilians continue to pay the price.
Residents say the situation is getting worse each day. They fear the longer the markets are closed and relief supplies are unable to reach those trapped in the city, the greater the human suffering.
And butterflies, an insectarium, and futuristic displays in a new wing of the Natural History Museum in New York City. Today is Wednesday, May 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. With barely a week to go before a deadline that could come as soon as June 1st, talks continued Tuesday at the U.S. Capitol as negotiators for President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy worked to avert a potentially chaotic federal default. I spoke with Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor and current professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. So, Professor, how dangerous is this brinksmanship?
It's very risky. The worst that can happen is that America defaults on our debts for the first time in history, which will seriously damage the full faith and credit of the United States, increase interest rates dramatically because all bonds will become riskier, not just bonds from the United States, not just bonds issued by the United States, but also all lending becomes riskier. The stock market is likely to fall fairly dramatically, and over the longer term, the dollar could become very shaky as an international currency because the globe has expected and assumed that the dollar was very safe given the power of the United States.
Besides it hurting the U.S. economy in what sounds like pretty devastating ways, what would it do for other world economies? Would it have an impact as well?
Well, it will obviously have a ripple effect on other economies because so many other economies are intertwined or interdependent or dependent on the United States economy in one way or another. The United States economy is the largest economy in the world. And so if the currency and debts of the United States are no longer credible, then that ripple will shake the entire global economy.
As far as our own economy?
We don't know. It's never happened before, but it's hard to conceive of how a default on the debts of the United States could occur without it being a kind of economic Armageddon for America. And the full faith and credit of the United States will be harmed.
So why do we go through this, what seems to be every year? Why do we have a debt limit?
There is no reason for having a debt limit. It doesn't limit the debt. That's one of the problems in terms of confusion, because the actual wording we use, a debt limit, sounds as though it does limit the debt. All it limits is the capacity of the federal government to pay the debts owed by the United States. And that's very different than a debt limit per se.
Why, if this is money that's already been spent, is this even, do we see this dance?
Unfortunately, it has become something that is used in the arsenal of political weapons. But what is new now is that we see one political party using it to hold the entire American economy hostage to its goals. And it is very, very difficult for the United States to function if this dance continues. We have come fairly close before in terms of the full faith and credit of the United States being jeopardized, but we are right now closer than we have ever come before.
If we have never come this dangerously close, does it have the potential to already be doing damage?
Yes, it easily has potential to be doing damage right now. That is the standing of the dollar, the standing of the public debt of the United States is already in some jeopardy. I would be very surprised if the credit rating of the United States were not seriously impeded, if credit rating agencies did not downgrade the credit of the United States, causing American taxpayers have to pay much more to borrow money in the future.
If it gets resolved tomorrow, will that change the equation?
If the Biden administration and House Republicans say, that's it, we've agreed, it's over, and raise the debt ceiling, that would be fine. But my fear is that it's going to drag on. These things do not happen overnight. The Senate is not in session this week. The House will be not in session on Friday for Memorial Day weekend. You need a number of days to put a bill into the form of law, to get it enacted, to resolve any differences between the House and the Senate, and to get it to the president's desk. This all takes time. We do not have time.
Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor and current professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. The United States is confirming there has been an encounter between a pair of its strategic bombers and a Russian fighter jet. Details from VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, in Washington.
The Russian Defense Ministry characterizes an incident over the Baltic Sea as an interception by one of its Su-27 fighter jets of two B-1B strategic bombers. The Pentagon spokesman, Air Force Brigadier General Pat Ryder, downplayed the encounter when asked about it by reporters on Tuesday.
It was a safe and professional interaction with Russian aircraft, so nothing significant to report on that front.
The general says the bombers, part of the Air Force Global Strike Command, were participating in a long-planned exercise in Europe. Officials in Moscow say the American aircraft did not cross the Russian border. In recent months, there have been several hazardous incidents between Russian military planes and aircraft of NATO countries. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
A Russian court on Tuesday extended for 3 months the pretrial detention of Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, who was arrested in March on espionage charges, which he and his employer deny. White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre at Tuesday's briefing said President Biden is deeply concerned.
We are deeply concerned that Russia has extended the pretrial detention of Evan Gershkovich by an additional 3 months today. We have been very clear that the claims against him are baseless.
The Russian court's closed-door hearing was emblematic of the secrecy that has marked the case against the first U.S. correspondent since the Cold War to be detained in Russia on spying charges. Residents in Sudan's capital reported fighting Tuesday, including artillery fire, on what was supposed to be the first full day of a week-long ceasefire. The continued fighting shows no sign of stopping as civilians continue to pay the price, enduring food shortages, electrical outages, and constant fear. Sadamed Ibrahim has more from Khartoum in this report, narrated by Vincent McCorry.
Civilians in Khartoum describe brutal conditions in the city as a result of the violence that broke out there in mid-April. Many say they have nearly run out of supplies. Markets are shuttered and imports are no longer entering the country. Yusuf Ahmed is a merchant in the city.
Some people cannot bear this situation, and we ask God for safety. For me, as a grocer, the situation is very bad. There are no goods, and we feel insecure because we could be looted at any moment. Some merchants now store goods in their homes.
According to the United Nations, nearly 19 million Sudanese could suffer from food insecurity due to the conflict. Advocates said $445 million is needed to support refugees fleeing Sudan and to provide aid in the next 6 months.
The situation has deteriorated dramatically and living conditions have become very bad and low. People have begun to store food supplies and most stores are lacking basic necessities. The price of flour is very expensive, and the price of bread has doubled. People want to travel outside Khartoum, but tickets are also expensive, whether they are in the States or outside Sudan. This war destroyed many things. We hope things will get better.
In the absence of a functioning government and relief organizations, citizens in some neighborhoods of Khartoum organize voluntary initiatives to help alleviate the crisis for the poorest citizens. Hassan from a neighborhood called Jabra explained how citizen groups are coming together to deal with the impact of the conflict.
We obtained quantities of flour from some agents and distributed it to a large number of poor citizens in the neighborhood and solved the problem of flour shortages. We have some security, economic, and health problems. We will form three committees concerned with the health situation, the living situation, and the security situation. We will work to collect information, and in the same way we address the flour shortage, we will try to provide health and medical services for all patients in the neighborhood by bringing in doctors and medicine. If we are not able, we will offer moral support in these circumstances.
Residents say the situation is getting worse each day. They fear the longer the markets are closed and relief supplies are unable to reach those trapped in the city, the greater the human suffering will be. For Sid Hamid Ibrahim in Khartoum, Sudan, Vincent Macquarie, VOA News.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has arrived in Australia for an official visit. Talks with the Australian government are expected to focus on defense, trade, and renewable energy, Phil Mercer reports.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi last visited Australia in 2014. Much has changed in the bilateral relationship since then. Defence and security ties have become stronger. Last year, the two nations signed an interim trade deal. Formal negotiations on a full pact are expected to begin shortly. About 20,000 people are expected at a rally Tuesday at Sydney Olympic Park for an address by Modi. His Australian counterpart Anthony Albanese also will attend as Australia approaches a milestone of 1 million people of Indian origin. Members of the Indian diaspora will travel from around Australia for the event. A group of Greens Party senators in Canberra have urged Albanese to raise human rights violations against minority groups in India during talks with Modi. Activists have said that dozens of rights campaigners are in jail across India following politically motivated prosecutions. Indian government officials have had no response to the allegations so far. Analysts believe there could also be protests at the Sydney rally against Modi by Muslim and Sikh activists. Ian Hall is the acting director of the Griffith Asia Institute at Queensland's Griffith University. He told VOA that geopolitical tensions in the Indo-Pacific region have intensified ties between Canberra and New Delhi.
Look, China hangs over all of this. I think we would have seen Australia and India come together over time, but that would have happened over a 30 or 40 year period. What's accelerated this relationship and really catalyzed the relationship is the deterioration of relations with China. And working together now in order to ensure some kind of balance of power and influence in the region has become a kind of the central driving force of the relationship between the two countries.
Australia and India are members of the Quad Security Dialogue, an alliance that also includes Japan and the United States. India is the world's largest democracy and has overtaken China as the most populous nation, according to the United Nations. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Residents of Guam are stockpiling supplies and filling emergency shelters as Super Typhoon Mawar bears down as the strongest storm to approach the U.S. Pacific territory in decades. President Biden approved an emergency declaration ahead of Mawar, which could arrive as a monster Category 5 storm. Media freedom advocacy groups and journalists in Pakistan have demanded authorities immediately reveal the fate and whereabouts of a popular television anchor arrested nearly 2 weeks ago as he tried to leave the country. Police have said they don't have the reporter in custody anymore. And Greece's two main opposition parties on Tuesday turned down mandates offered to them to form a coalition government, setting the stage for a second election in June after an inconclusive vote on May 21st. This is VOA News.
VOA Science Beat. Like humans, baboons get by with a little help from their friends. According to a new study published in Science Advances, forming close social bonds as adults helps the primates triumph over childhood adversity and live longer. Research in humans has found that people who experience early trauma, such as having an alcoholic parent or growing up in an abusive home, are more likely to face an early grave. Researchers found that the effect of hardships in primates was cumulative, with each additional exposure translating to 1.4 years of life lost. The team found that baboons who form strong friendships, as measured by how often they groom their closest associates, restored 2.2 years of their lives, regardless of early hardships. I'm VOA's Steve Miller.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres Tuesday said war is devastating lives around the globe, lamenting the world is failing to live up to its commitments to protect countless civilians in conflict zones. From Ukraine and Sudan to Africa, Sahel, and the Middle East, a growing number of civilians are caught in conflicts and scrambling to evade missiles and explosives and to find food and medicine.
War means hunger. Armed conflict is a key factor driving food insecurity around the world. Last year, more than 117 million people faced acute hunger primarily because of war and insecurity. And this is an outrage. Damage to critical infrastructure hampers food production, blocks distribution, and deprives people of safe water.
Guterres said peace is the best form of protection, and in the coming weeks he plans to issue a report called A New Agenda for Peace in preparation for next year's Summit of the Future. A new wing of the American Museum of Natural History in New York City officially opened to the public in early May. The futuristic addition features new galleries, including an insectarium, a butterfly vivarium, floor-to-ceiling displays of collections, and more. Evgeny Maslov has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Some 4 million artifacts and specimens will find a home there, with some going on display for the first time. The Gilder Center connects the other 10 museum wings that take up about 4 city blocks in all. Project architect Jeannie Gang says the building's interior is intended to remind visitors of canyons and caves. The idea behind the design was to illustrate how things are interconnected in nature and how one part of it inspires all the others.
When I first started to design it, I was really thinking about what kind of landscape makes you curious, makes you want to explore. And you think of all the old adventurers going out into canyons and discovering geological formations. So I really studied those to see what it was about them that makes you curious.
One of the collections in the new wing is dedicated to insects. An insectarium features a monumental model of a beehive and a live colony of tropical leaf-cutting ants that visitors can watch behind glass. The museum also has its own butterfly vivarium with a humid tropical climate that houses 80 butterfly species. One of the top floors of the museum is dedicated to sea animals, and another has special labs where visitors can watch museum staff work with specimens. On the wing's fourth floor is a large library with a collection of rare books, and visitors can spend some quiet time in the reading room. It's a monumental investment in the importance of learning and teaching others about our natural world. For Evgeny Maslov in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Mohamed Kordofani's Goodbye Julia is the first Sudanese film to be included in the official selection at the Cannes Film Festival. It premiered on Monday against the backdrop of conflict in Khartoum. David Doyle with Reuters has more.
For director Mohamed Kordofani, walking the red carpet at the Cannes Film Festival is a strange experience.
It's a confusing feeling. It's a bittersweet.
His film, Goodbye Julia, is the first from Sudan to be included in the festival's official selection. He is, he says, immensely honored and very happy.
But at the same time, I feel really bad I walk the red carpet while people are running away from bullets and bombing. Weeks
of fighting between two military factions in Sudan has driven nearly 1.1 million people from their homes and killed hundreds. It is the latest chapter in a history that has too often been written in blood. Goodbye Julia, which premiered at Cannes, focuses on another period of instability. It explores the effect of South Sudan's split from Sudan in 2011, which Kordofani describes as rooted in social reasons.
And I found myself guilty of this myself because I didn't know any Southern Sudanese, although there were millions of them in Khartoum. It seems like we have managed to create some sort of an apartheid, even if it's not like formal or announced, but these communities are completely segregated, and this really fuels the problem.
Goodbye Julia stars theatre actor and singer Iman Youssef and model Siran Riak. Youssef plays Mona, a retired singer from northern Sudan who tries to erase her guilt after covering up a murder by taking the victim's South Sudanese widow, Julia, into her home. It's shot in 4x3, which Kordofani says emphasizes the claustrophobic feeling inside Mona's home. Relations between Sudan and South Sudan remain tense to this day. In Sudan's latest crisis, Kordofani is wishing for reconciliation. I hope we can build a new national identity, he says, built around values like freedom, justice, and coexistence.
David Doyle with Reuters reporting. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On February 15, 2011, the Libyan civil war began with anti-government demonstrations in Benghazi. Due to the violent response of the Libyan government against the protesters, little more than 2 weeks later, the United Nations Security Council referred the situation there to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. As a result, the ICC can exercise its jurisdiction over crimes against humanity and war crimes committed on the territory of Libya or by its nationals from 15th of February 2011 onwards. There is no doubt that in the ensuing 12 years, Libya has seen little peace. The war ended in October 2011, but another followed just 3 years later. In the chaos, terrorists attempted to gain a foothold there, while warlords split the country, fighting over territory and oil fields. Caught in the middle of the violence was the civilian population, and in the meantime, opportunists of every stripe preyed on refugees from neighboring countries heading for Libya's ports on the Mediterranean Sea in hopes of a chance to cross into Europe. It is therefore no surprise that a recent visit by the UN Independent Fact-Finding Mission on Libya found a wide array of war crimes and crimes against humanity against Libyans and migrants, including repression of civic groups, arbitrary detention, murder, rape, enslavement, extrajudicial killing, and enforced disappearance. With this information in hand, the ICC was finally able to issue several new arrest warrants and file for additional ones. The work of the ICC in Libya plays a critical role in support of our collective pursuit of accountability, peace, and security, said Mark Simonoff, United States legal advisor at the UN.
The investigative and cooperative activities undertaken by the Office of the Prosecutor have laid the foundations for accountability in the face of ongoing challenges in Libya and a difficult operating environment.
Resolving political uncertainty and promoting accountability in Libya will go a long way towards addressing the chronic instability Libya continues to face, said Mr. Simonoff.
Human rights violations and abuses will continue unless meaningful steps are taken to address the chronic instability in Libya. A critical step towards peace and stability is the withdrawal of all armed groups and mercenaries from Libya without further delay.
The people of Libya deserve stability and justice, said Mr. Simonoff, and we support the International Criminal Court's efforts to help bring justice to the people of Libya.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.